Welcome to Curious About, the podcast with great entrepreneurs, founders, and hidden champions who share their story and give insights into what it takes to run a business. Here is your host, Dr. Jens Pippi.
Welcome to Curious About. My name is Jens Pippich, and today I'm at Web Summit and I have a very special guest with me. His name is Peter Mollman and he is the CEO of Trustpilot. So Peter, why don't you explain a little bit what Trustpilot does?
So Trustpilot is the place where you as a potential customer of a business sees what other customers think before you buy. Or where if you have a business, you will invite all your customers to tell them what they think about you on Trustpilot, partially so that you can get to know your customers better and learn from them, but also that you can show to people that consider buying from you that you are a reputable business that will deliver a great customer experience. And we've been going at it for 12 years now. So in web terms, I'm now approaching dinosaur age.
Exactly.
But we're still only just at have reached what I feel is a percentage of what we can become, because the things that defines today's day and age is very much around what can you trust. Trusting institutions, yeah. An abundance of information, powerful consumers, and companies increasingly realizing that they need to compete on the customer experience and not on price. So we've raised $190 million, roughly.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. And we're 800 and something people spread over 7 offices globally.
Amazing. So before we, jump into the current challenges and what's going on the web, tell us a bit about the beginnings, because you said you've been active now for 12 years. So how did it all start? How did you start?
Yeah, so I was a student and I had a little e-commerce company. And I had two problems. So one was that people like my parents would sometimes buy things online and get bad experiences. And it could be very hard to know what was a good company to buy from and which was not. And so I thought it would be incredibly useful if we could give them a place where they could see what other people thought and collect all the wisdom of the internet into one place, so that whenever mom gets a new kitchen, she gets a great kitchen. Or whenever mom and dad goes on a holiday in France, they get a great holiday. So that was the one side of it. The other side of it was that my little company was selling electronics on eBay. And the great thing about eBay is that every time a purchase is completed, eBay will say, hey, how did it go? And so that's why the idea of buying, for example, a used cell phone from a gentleman in Hong Kong who promises that it's as good as new, isn't that crazy? Because 10,000 other people have done so. And so we were selling quite a lot on the eBays of the world. And then we started a website, and because we thought we were also going to sell on the web. The trouble was that everybody visited the website thought, Peter is probably just a kid in a basement selling electronics. And unfortunately, that was true.
Yes.
So they didn't trust us and they didn't buy from us. So I realized if you're a company, you can actually do a lot better if you can show people in a reliable way that your customers love you. And just saying that is meaningless. Just me saying like, hey, we have a lot of happy customers. Like what CEO would not say that? So it was needed to create a third party, an independent third party that could vouch for the validity of the content and ensure that you could actually trust it. And then you could say like eBay, wasn't they already there? Yes, but I didn't want to send people to eBay because on eBay I had 60 competitors all trying to underbid me on price. So that was a horrible place to send a potential customer. And so with Trustpilot, that was the solution for my parents, people like them. It was the solution for my own problem. And then it actually turned out that I had a lot of friends who were entrepreneurs. Good friend of mine, he was selling pictures that he would print for you and put them on a beautiful frame. And he was competing with Vistaprint. Mm-hmm. And so he had a bit of the same problem in the sense that everybody would almost always buy from Vistaprint because they knew what they were getting. Mm-hmm. And so how could he show that he was as good, and how could he show maybe that he was even better and that he was really caring about the customers and putting in all the effort to create something special for you? And that was the idea. And today, we've gone from when we started, we had somewhere between a couple of hundred reviews to a couple of thousand that friends had written. Mm-hmm. And today we have more than 70 million reviews of several hundred thousand companies. And we're one of the 500 most visited websites in the world.
Amazing. So when you had the great idea of, providing customers with, trust, or at least a source for trust, I believe that not everything went easy. You know, when you started and you think, well, I should have some 5-star review system. Now let's sell to some companies because someone essentially has to pay for it. How did that go?
So initially I remember I was speaking with business owners. Typically I would be the person calling them. Mm-hmm. And I would say, what people are writing about you online matters. Other potential customers are reading it. And you need to show customer opinions. And many people thought that was the craziest thing they'd ever hear anyone say.
Because they thought they would get bad reviews?
Partially because they were afraid of getting bad reviews. Partially because they didn't think the customers cared that much. Mm-hmm. And I think initially, it was very much the visionaries or the people that really deeply obsessed over customer service that got it. So the typical first customer for me would be a company where they said, hey, we care more about customer service and the customer experience than anybody else, but we don't get points for it. Mm-hmm. Of course, like you're going to tell your friends and so on, and we will say that in ads, but how do we really show this? We're competing against companies that may be selling it for less than we are. Mm-hmm. How do we show that we're better? And they wanted that reward for that. You know, mm-hmm. they put in so much hard work. They would stay late to give great customer service. Whenever something was wrong, they would send you an apology and a bottle of wine and fix your problem immediately. How do they get rewarded for that? And then there were the visionaries that really understood the way the internet was going. Because this was also very much a time of change in the sense that when I started the company, there was no Facebook, or maybe there was just around a Facebook, but I wasn't on Facebook. Yeah. I was not on LinkedIn. I was not on Twitter. And so in parallel with it, so initially when we started the company, the notion of people sharing things online, it was early. Maybe somebody would create a blog. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Or they would contribute to a forum somewhere. But then in parallel with Trustpilot, suddenly the entire world got used to tweeting and submitting updates and sharing pictures of what they had for lunch. Mm-hmm. And so we were early to the market, which was good because we were very inexperienced and we had a lot of things we needed to figure out. So it was fortunate that we got a couple of years to get the model right and really put on that hard work it is to get the product and market fit right. Mm-hmm.
So, and now with you being a source for reviews and ratings for companies and transactions and whatever, how do you fight the growing phenomenon of fake information and fake reviews and everything on the web?
Yeah, so we actually see that as one of our, you can say, reasons for existing. Mm-hmm. Is that somebody has to be the one that says we need to invest in ensuring that this information is useful and that people are not getting manipulated. Because of course, what has happened is that the first thing that happened was that consumers really started to care about what other customers think. And then of course, some people have sinister motives and they start to try to manipulate that. And for us, it's everything we think about is how do we do the best job we can in preventing that from happening. So what we do is we do a number of things. So the biggest thing is data and machine learning that looks at what is a typical normal user behavior. and we're looking at more than 100 data points.
Like, so, for example?
So that could, for example, be it's just a very, very simple data point that everybody can relate to. Where is this review coming from? Mm-hmm. So if you're a company in Berlin or Hamburg, and normally your customers are from Germany. and suddenly you're getting hundreds of reviews from the other side of the world. Well, that's interesting, and could trigger an alarm in our system. And then you can say, well, can they just fake their IP addresses or hide them from us? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is yes, but what's the normal percentage of people who have hidden them? So yeah. That becomes weird again. And these are just the obvious data points. And then there are several more that are a lot less obvious. So what this means is that it's very much like banks are combating credit card abuse, mm-hmm. in the sense that they'll say, hey, you just went to Lidl, and 5 minutes later, your credit card was used in China. Jens, we don't think you could have made it to China in 5 minutes. This is strange. We blocked the card. And you're like, okay, yeah. Fair enough. Because that was just one trigger where that yeah. was. And the more data you have, the better. So then we have the computers looking at the data and just sorting out what's obviously bad. Mm-hmm. And then we have a team of dedicated people. We have more than 30 people who just look at reviews where either the computer has said it's not entirely sure, but a human should look at it, or the millions of people that are using Trustpilot have contacted us and said, actually, this company is suspicious. So, for example, sometimes we say that the people are writing and saying, hey, my boss is gaming your system. Mm-hmm. So you have people working for businesses where they're whistleblowers, where they're not, you can say, want to be a part of unethical behavior, or you have people like yourselves, journalists that will or bloggers, podcasters that says like, hey, I bought from this company, has such good reviews and trust, but how can that be? So what does this mean? It means that if there is only a single review, it can be impossible to detect if your friend wrote it, yeah. or if your mom wrote it. But
that's how you started.
That's how we started. But if there are hundreds of reviews, and so that they actually have an impact, then normally we do a very, very good job of ensuring that they are real.
Is this more a phenomenon of companies trying to boost their reviews and their scores for their own website, or is it more a phenomenon that companies try to, you know, reduce the score of their competitors?
Yeah, so it is by far the most normal that they're trying to boost their own score. Mm-hmm. So of course you hear this where a competitor will say, oh, this review is only bad because it's my competitor that wrote it. And then we have this procedure in Trustpilot where we reach out to people, and sometimes we'll ask them to provide a proof of purchase, which is something we call it. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, it's very, very often that the competitor turns out to be a customer that just happened to have a bad experience. Mm-hmm. But of course it happens, and that's why we have these very robust methods, and that's also why every company can just, for free, they can get a profile on Trustpilot, they can invite their customers to tell them what they think about them, and they can flag the reviews to our compliance team that will then take a look at them. But by far the most normal is that the business will try to self-inflate mm-hmm. its own image. But just building on that, I think people should also be aware that the vast majority of all businesses are actually honest. And in today's age, it doesn't sound like when I'm saying these words, I'm like, really? Yes, but really. So if you imagine that you go to the like a busy rail station, and you're in the morning, and you have all these people coming to work today, and you're saying like, so are you coming to work today to cheat people? Or are you going to work today to create a fake image of your business? And most people say no. Most people say, and most companies are actually just trying to sell mm-hmm. their products and create great experiences. And I think when people listen to this podcast, I think the vast majority of people listening hopefully will have the same, where they're not out to manipulate. They're actually just out to show that they have a great customer experience and try to create a great customer experience.
Growing the company from, you know, essentially yourself to now more than 800 people, I mean, must have been quite a, you know, interesting experience, to say the least. So what has changed for you as a CEO in terms of, you know, dealing now with way more people than you've ever before? You probably don't know everybody by name and all these kinds of things. So what has that, you know, made with you and your leadership?
So anybody listening who's going through this journey, there are a couple of things I'd like them to realize. So the first thing is that you need to reinvent your mind's operating system at least every 18 months. So as the company is growing, and when you're 10 people, there's a certain way of leading the business that's really efficient. It's typically by being the one that's doing the most. Mm-hmm. You just need to work harder and sell more or write more code or just really show the way and get the product right. But then when you get to 100 people, people stop knowing each other. And then it becomes more about setting the right leadership team and creating a culture that leads to good decisions in the business. Then when it scales even further, it becomes very much around processes for decision making and clarity of decision making. So it's about telling people who has the right to make which decision, why was it made, and who should know about that, and what does it matter. And it's a very different mindset. Setting up these structures is a completely different part of your brain and personality than the early stage CEO who says, what's the right product? What can we create here that adds value? What's the key feature we need to build that unlocks user adoption? It's also a very different mindset from the high-fiving CEO when you're 50 or 60, 100 people and growing fast, and that's inviting people for drinks after work and tries to energize people with the culture. And whenever you are going through such an update of your mental operating system, it can be rather grueling, because the reason that you're updating it is because you know that you're wrong. Mm-hmm. The behavior that used to be successful is no longer successful. And it's a little bit like you play a computer game and you find like, oh, I'm just doing this and this and this. And then you reach this level where you just can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. Until you figure out some new things. And then you can continue and you can do more. And then you hit a wall again. So I think people has to prepare for a lot of self-criticism and a lot of soul searching. And also that can sometimes be a bit of a lonely process, because you can ask people for advice, but ultimately it is you that has to find the answers. And also you have to find the answers that works for you, mm-hmm. not for everybody else.
And I believe also that, I mean, there is no guarantee that you as a CEO of a growing company are still the right person to lead the organization once you've reached a certain number of people, right? Because, you might be a good, you know, startup entrepreneur, you know, with great feature ideas, but maybe you're not a great process optimizer or energizer or whatever.
Exactly, 100%.
So how do you know when is the right time to, you know, get someone else take over the operational side of things or strategy side of things, if that's not your or the thing you're good with?
So of course it's extremely hard for me to give a direct sharp answer and say, you know what, if this and this and this, but that's not very helpful for the listeners if I say that, so I can give some general advice. So what happens first of all is that I think it's okay if you can't figure it out for about 6 months to a year. Mm-hmm. But if after 6 months to a year you still feel, I haven't figured it out, then you need to start searching your soul for, is are you the problem? And potentially you can meet people very, very discreetly and see, are they capable of doing things that are that you're not capable of? And the other part is asking yourself, are you enjoying yourself? Mm-hmm. And are you enjoying the things that are the most necessary? And again, it is okay if for a while you are not enjoying things. It is a natural part of building a company is that there are tough times when you can't figure it out and there are problems you cannot solve. But ultimately, after a while, you have to enjoy the things you're supposed to be good at in order for you to be really good at them. And so I have learned to enjoy the creation of structure in my business. As a person, I'm extremely unstructured and chaotic and impulsive. And sometimes that can be great because it can be energizing and motivating. But now I have really learned that for the business, I have to be the one that cares the most about getting things into procedures and structures, because otherwise at this stage, it'll just crash. And so I have learned to develop a love for the well-oiled engine. And I've seen other people where they're just not me. Mm-hmm. And they maybe remain in love with other things. And I think that is a totally good thing. There's this stigma as a CEO that almost for the love of God, you have to stay on. And I would say with people, if after a year you're not having fun and you feel for a year you haven't had fun, then it's probably time to think mm-hmm. about it.
And did you imagine it would be like it is right now when you started the business? And you're probably envisioning, oh, at some time I would be, you know, this and this big, or had this and this many employees or whatever. And I assume it's going to be great, right? And now you're there, and reflecting back on what you were thinking when you started, was it, or is it like you imagined it?
So I imagine that this company would become very big, very fast. In some sense, I actually thought it would go faster, and I was a very naive, which was a good thing, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have started it. But in terms of the lived reality, there is no way I could have imagined what it is actually like. So it's not even that I imagined it in a wrong way. I was just utterly incapable of imagining the life with the 850 employees and the senior management team and the offices and the type of problems we'd be dealing with. So it's more a comparison with there is something that I had never even envisioned.
Mm-hmm. And had you started it, had you known what it's like?
100%. This has been the best thing I ever did for myself. I have gotten to know myself much better. And I have gained a confidence from it that I don't want to be without. Mm-hmm. It has, I think it was something that I love to do is to say, what should the world be like? Mm-hmm. So what's really funny is just to say, there's something that bothers you about the world. Can you change that? And I think I always enjoy making that change that makes the world better in my eyes. And with Trustpilot, I'm going to keep applying that at Trustpilot for the next 5-10 years, probably. But then looking at it in a life perspective, this is also a fantastic ticket to allow yourself to do that in other contexts that I haven't even thought about yet. Mm-hmm. It's like I have qualified for the Champions League in some sense, and so in the future I will also get to play and solve problems with interesting people.
So, and what are the biggest challenges for Trustpilot?
There are really two challenges. So the one is about always staying ahead of the curve on remaining trusted and. It's a little bit of a cat and a mouse game between us and the people that are trying to manipulate the system, and it's important that we always stay ahead. Something that's also really important for us is to educate consumers about how companies are using Trustpilot and how they're using reviews and how that matters for people's perception of them. So, for example, it says a lot about a business if it's responding to the negative reviews or if it goes into war with the people that wrote the negative reviews. And that's something that we're very keen to highlight, because I think for myself and for other people, would you rather buy from the company that fixes your problem and gives you some a nice gift as we're sorry? Or do you want to buy from the company that says you forgot to read page 17 or on our terms and conditions and we're going to come after you because you wrote that negative review? It really says a lot about the mindset and what kind of company you want to do business with. So for us, the transparency of that behavior, well, we want to really reward the good company. So again, it's coming back to, I think in the future, it'll matter almost more how you got your reviews than what the reviews are. Mm-hmm. Because how you got your reviews signifies a mindset, and it signifies an attitude to customer experience, that you're not just doing this to look good, you're doing this because you want to be good. And in the future, I think that's what customers will appreciate more.
Mm-hmm. What's Trustpilot going to be like in 10 years, and where are you in 10 years?
So in 10 years, well, who knows, maybe I'm in this chair again, speaking with you about the previous 10 years. I don't have any plans to do anything else, but I've also learned 10 years is a very long time. So who knows? Hopefully by then I have a family. Hopefully think that I was so naive sitting here today telling you the things that I said, because now I know better. And I hope that Trustpilot has made a meaningful contribution to the world on two fronts. So one is, I find one of the biggest problems in the world today is a lack of trust, and a lack of trust in online institutions. And so I hope that we could contribute with solutions there. And then I hope that we could inspire companies to be really focusing on the customer experience.
Have you ever thought about, you know, applying this technology and system that you have to more than just, you know, transactional shopping experience online, in terms of, you know, elections or whatever? I'm just, you know, making it up right now.
Yeah, so certainly. So first of all, maybe I should just add that in 10 years, a part of me is actually thinking, like, it could also be very nice just to be surfing a little bit. Yeah. But let's see. And in terms of that, there's definitely going to become a company that is called something like Ethics Pilot, where you're seeing, is the company you're buying from, are they paying taxes? Is the company you're buying from using child labor? Are they paying fair wages? And you will be able to see that, and you're going to be able to make judgments on whether or not you want to buy from that company. That information is going to become transparent. It is to be decided if that company is going to be, if that problem is going to be solved by Trustpilot. And similarly, there is going to be a company, I hope, that's going to say, this information that is spread online is right, or this information is wrong, to be decided if that company is Trustpilot or not. I think right now, if you think about it, there are 200 million websites in the world, and there are tens of millions of companies. We only have 300,000 domains with reviews on Trustpilot. So just in terms of solving the original problem, we're less than 1% to goal.
So there's still, you know, a lot of room for growth.
Indeed.
And what do your investors say? Because you mentioned that you have, you know, quite some fundraising. Are they pushing for an IPO? Are they, or what do you want?
Yeah, so the investors, of course, they're very long-term oriented. And so right now they're really supporting us and just trying to build a very great company. Of course, at some point, they rightfully need to see a return on their investment. I don't feel that that's creating an undue pressure on the company. Because in a sense, because the only reason we provide anything of value is if people trust us, right? So I could write a review on a piece of paper and it would be worthless unless you trust me. And so I think around the table there's a realization that whatever we do, we have to maintain that trust in the business and invest in that long-term viability of the company. But I think it's natural also that one day it could be very natural for a company like us to IPO. So right now what we're doing is that we're creating a company that we can IPO. And that's the step one. And then step two is then you say, do we actually want to at this time? Is it the right time? Is it the right for the business? But I look at it a little bit like getting fit. Mm-hmm. And so we're upgrading our processes and so on. But we haven't pushed this button or we're in IPO mode. And we may as well just use the money we have raised and say, actually, that's... We don't need to raise any more money. The only reason we're spending money is to invest into more growth. And so if we just slow down a little bit, we will become profitable and we can just reinvest that. Or you do like some of other companies have done recently where you do a big private round and then remain private for longer.
Yeah.
So at the moment we have these three options in our hand. Mm-hmm. And when we sit here in 10 years, we'll know.
Great. So thank you very much for these insights and for your time. And I'm excited to see what the next 10 years will bring, and then we speak again.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to it, Jens. Pleasure being here.
You've been listening to Curious About, the podcast with great entrepreneurs, founders, and hidden champions with Dr. Jens Pippig. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play and get fresh new episodes. Until next time, stay curious.